Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today. Doctors Mark Bronstein and Sophia Sahid, both from NYU Grossman and Long Island, convened for a live X-Spaces discussion about key presentations in hematologic oncology at the 2026 ASCO meeting. They discussed the abstracts that may shake up practice across multiple myeloma, leukemia, lymphoma, and other areas.
I'm Mark Bronstein. I'm associate professor of medicine at the NYU Grossman Long Island School of Medicine. My focus is primarily B-cell malignancies, and I'm joined by one of our stellar first-year fellows who's going to introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Sophia Zahid. I'm a first-year fellow here at NYU in Long Island. My first time here at ASCO, or being part of this great meeting, and I'm very excited to be here.
Great. So we're going to kick it off by starting with two abstracts that I'll start the presentation for. And then Dr. Zahid will do two abstracts, and then we'll discuss each one at a time. And these are all focused on hematologic malignancies, covering a broad spectrum of heme malignancies. So let's start off with abstract 7512. This is a belantamab mafodotin with daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone in transplant-ineligible, newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients, a phase 1/2 BELLA-DRD study. So we know that belantamab is an antibody drug conjugate against BCMA. It was reapproved in October 2025 based on the DREAM-7 study, which showed an OS and PFS improvement with BELLA-VD versus DARA-VD in 494 patients who were mostly DARA-naive after at least one prior line of therapy. However, there are currently no anti-BCMA antibody drug conjugates, bispecifics, or CAR-T approved in the first line. So in this abstract presented by Terpos and colleagues at ASCO 2026, they're going to be presenting the phase 1/2 BELLA-DRD study for newly diagnosed myeloma patients who are ineligible for transplant. In this dose-finding part 1, 24 patients were studied and had an overall response rate of 92% at a median follow-up of 34 months with a 70% VGPR or better depth of response. And 12 patients in the dose expansion part 2, there was an overall response rate of 92% and a PFS of 92% at 18 months, which is fairly high. There were about 20% visual assessments that were grade 3 or higher, which is a known side effect of Bella. So I think this study demonstrates the robustness of immunotherapy quads. You know, for cross comparison, the final analysis of Cepheus with DARA-VRd is also being presented at ASCO this year, and the median PFS there was not reached versus 76 months. So I think, you know, this study with Bella is kind of approaching that PFS. And there are studies ongoing of upfront bispecifics and CAR-T targeted BCMA as well that have yet to be presented. So I think we can do a quick discussion of this abstract. Where in the landscape might, you know, belantamab fall? Do you think people would be using it in the first line, or do you think we'll be using more other BCMA targeting agents like CAR-T or bispecifics?
I know it hasn't quite made it into first line yet, but it is something very exciting. It would be using the landscape where we're able to have a proteasome inhibitor-free quad used and be able to maybe save that therapy for later lines. We'd also be able to save, you know, kind of protect from the risk of like peripheral neuropathy or the GI toxicity that occurs with, bortezomib or these proteasome inhibitors. And so I can see that it would be used in, you know, earlier lines of therapy in comparison to, like I said.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think for an off-the-shelf regimen like belantamab that, you know, does have a REMS program associated with it to monitor for ocular toxicity. In this study, it was about 20% of patients who did have grade 3, but it does tend to be reversible. And I think this is a quad regimen that can be delivered in the community that has signals of high efficacy in the follow up for this early phase 1-2 study. So, I think that it's good to have different options to target BCMA, which seems to be a very robust target in myeloma, and yet to be determined what the optimal mechanism is to target. But clearly, immunotherapy quads, as you mentioned, without proteasome inhibitors, may be the wave of the future. So why don't we move on to the next abstract? So this is abstract 6505. This is revumenib as maintenance for AML following allogeneic stem cell transplant. So revumenib was the first menin inhibitor FDA approved since 2024 for relapse refractory AML with a KMT2A or menin rearrangement, or for patients with an NPM1 mutation. And it basically works by preventing transcription of leukemogenic genes. Currently, there are no agents FDA approved as maintenance following allogeneic stem cell transplant for AML, though NCCN guidelines suggest that a FLT3 inhibitor or hypomethylating agent is appropriate in the maintenance setting following transplant. So this study by Goulart and colleagues being presented at ASCO examined 21 patients, including 11 adult patients, most with a KMT2A rearrangement, about 76%. Following allogeneic transplant. At a median follow-up of 18 months, overall survival and event-free survival were not reached. The two-year overall survival was 89%, though 71% of patients had discontinued revumenib due to toxicity and relapse, 14% relapse. So, and 48% of patients needed a dose modification due to thrombocytopenia. So in summary, in a small cohort at a median of 3 prior lines of therapy, I think revumenib shows signs of efficacy, and longer term follow-up is really required to assess its efficacy and role in the maintenance setting. So I guess the question for Dr. Zahid for discussion, do you think maintenance will become standard of care post-transplant in general for AML?
I believe so. I will say that this seemed reassuring, but like you mentioned, it does have a small sample size. And I'd also note that they did discuss that thrombocytopenia was a very common, adverse event in grade 3+. We've seen in 43% of the patients, is 86% overall, and 48% of the patients required a dose modification. So I think that can be extremely challenging in real world practice, especially as there's inherently typically low platelet counts to begin with. And then in the addition with this medication and the maintenance phase, it may be very challenging to continue. But I think we'll be able to kind of see that, moving forward if there's larger studies that are done.
Yeah, it's a good point about toxicity, because these are patients who may have graft versus host disease, who may have prolonged thrombocytopenia following their transplant. And, adding maintenance into that setting can also increase the risk of toxicity. So, maybe there will be certain subgroups, like higher risk patients, who would benefit from this the most. And this study was enriched for patients who had a median of 3 prior lines of therapy, so were high risk for relapse. All right, why don't we move on to your 2 abstracts?
So for the first abstract, it's going to be the impact of outpatient CAR T cell therapy administration on healthcare utilization in patients with hematologic malignancies. This is brought from Dr. Suzanne Bowen at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. So a little bit of background, CAR T is standard care for multiple relapse and refractory hematologic malignancies. But the post-infusion period does, carry a great risk for CRS, ICANS, with the onset ranging from anywhere from a few days to anywhere from 7 to 10 days or a little bit more. And so a lot of patients are being monitored in a hospital setting or inpatient setting, somewhere from 7 to 14 days plus. And so there's, so a lot of limited data comparing, these two settings, including, some of the data just looking at CAR T in the outpatient settings at single centers, maybe a specific disease type or product specific type, which can limit the generalizability of this data. So in this study, it was a retrospective study looking at 293 patients receiving CAR T for any hematologic malignancy. And it was looked at a single institution, the Mayo Clinic, but at 3 different sites, at their main institution, Minnesota, and then also at Arizona and Florida over a 4-year course. And they compared the healthcare utilization across this. So the outpatient CAR T cell patients, they were doing remote monitoring And that was done in Rochester with 125 patients. And then the inpatient CAR T was done at their other sites in Arizona and Florida. Those were 90 and 78 patients, respectively. And in this setting, I will note that that required a 7-day mandatory inpatient monitoring. And so the results I saw, you know, they had similar baseline demographics, the characteristics across all the patients. Majority of the lymphoma patients were seeing a majority of lymphoma patients. And the median hospital days at 30 days for outpatient stay was 4 days versus inpatient was 13 days. And then similarly at 90 days, it was 4 days for the outpatient group and 13 days for the inpatient group. There was for the ICU admission in the first 30 days was fewer for the outpatient group versus the inpatient group. Similarly, for the one or more ED visits was seen less so for the outpatient group versus the inpatient group. And there was no difference in the patient portal use between the groups as well. And then in the first 30 days of the outpatient group, one outpatient visit, you know, 53% of those patients had a visit. And then 2% had two visits. And for the inpatient group, 29% of the patients had an outpatient visit and 2% had two visits. And there was no difference seen in the 30-day mortality between those patients. And so I think that, you know, this was, they had clinically meaningful endpoints in terms of looking at hospital days, ICU admissions, ED visits, portal use, 30-day mortality. But I will mention, you know, 7 days were required for the inpatient stay. So it was not really clinically driven. But I'm curious to see, you know, if the patients that were chosen maybe for the inpatient group versus the outpatient group, maybe the outpatient group had lower risk disease or lower risk features. And I'm also curious to see, you know, any of the CRS or ICANS data that would be surrounding some of, you know, the inpatient stays here. But, you know, this is very helpful to see that this can be done in certain settings with, you know, close remote monitoring. And maybe something that could be revolutionary or seen in the future. Dr. Bronstein, do you have any thoughts about that?
No, yeah, that was a great review of the abstract. I think that there are always going to be biases introduced by retrospective, you know, studies of patient selection for inpatient or outpatient. But, you know, I think that there are a number of reassuring elements of the study that this is feasible. You know, I think that we need to know how we can apply the data from, you know, large tertiary care cancer center like the Mayo Clinics to other programs, and what are the key features in place to allow for safe outpatient CAR T. I think also it's possible to have a hybrid model where maybe patients spend a limited time in the hospital, and if there's no side effects, no CRS, ICANS, then they go home sooner. But it was reassuring in the study. You know, I'm curious, like, What do you think are some of the challenges to outpatient CAR T?
I think a lot of it comes into, you know, how reliable our patient is, patient buy-in as well. And I think a big part is also the support that a patient has, and that may not be always feasible for, you know, in a lot of health centers or for a lot of patients, having the resources to be able to support patients in the outpatient setting, being able to have maybe a healthcare, you know, provider or a physician that's available, you know, pretty much almost around the clock for anything that can occur, any side effects, any issues. So I think, you know, in terms of being able to provide outpatient CAR T, it's something that can be feasible outside of maybe just a large academic center, but would require a lot of resource support and possibly, you know, resource in an academic center and having some sort of liaison or some sort of support from maybe an academic center that can be able to put forward that and help those patients get through that time period.
Yeah, so in some sites are using like remote telemonitoring, vital signs, things like that to assure a safe outpatient experience.
And then I have our last abstract here, which is the Frontmind study. This is a phase 3 study of tafasitamab plus lenalidomide and R-CHOP for patients with newly diagnosed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This is with Dr. Lenz here. So a little bit of background, you know, DLBCL, most common non-Hodgkin subtype. With R-CHOP, you know, cures more than half the patients, but the outcomes are worse for the high-risk patients, so those with an IPI score of 3 to 5. And with Pollock's trial, you know, that successfully challenged R-CHOP. So now the NCCN has a preferred first-line regimen for Category 1. For patients with stage 2 with extensive metastatic disease or stage 3-4 with the IPI of 2 or greater. And so the prior study, the first MIND phase 1b study, showed that tafasimab and lenalidomide with R-CHOP showed safety and efficacy in patients with newly diagnosed disease. And, you know, in terms of the needs or, you know, what we're looking to kind of accomplish is, you know, still a large portion of these DLBCL patients are not cured the first line R-CHOP. And we're still very large unmet need for high risk patients with an IPI score of 3 to 5. And so in this study, you know, it was double blinded. It had a large range of patients that were used anywhere from 18 to 80 years old with newly diagnosed high intermediate or high risk DLBCL. Or high-grade B-cell lymphoma with an IPI score of 3 to 5, which targeting the population with the greatest unmet need, as I mentioned earlier. And so it looked at tafa-len R-CHOP versus R-CHOP, and it had an investigator-assessed PFS. And so they used 889 total patients, which is a very large sample size here. And then just about half and half, so about 448 were in the tafa-len R-CHOP and 451 in the R-CHOP. And the median follow-up was at 35 months. And so tafa-len R-CHOP showed an improvement in PFS versus R-CHOP, and it was seen for both molecular cell of origin subtypes. And at 24 months, a PFS of 71% versus 62% that was seen in the R-CHOP alone. Tafa-len R-CHOP also showed an improvement in EFS. It showed a complete response, overall response rate that was similar for both. And in terms of, you know, any grade treatment-related adverse events, they were similar but in both treatment arms. However, there were more grade 3 plus events that were seen in the tafa-len R-CHOP and more discontinuation and death due to these adverse events. But overall, the tafa-len R-CHOP showed a 25% reduction in the risk of disease progression or death compared to R-CHOP with an absolute 24-month PFS of 8% in the overall population and 10% in the centrally confirmed subtypes. So I thought this was, you know, interesting, you know, article or frame shift in mind. You know, there is these two additional agents that are being added. And so, you know, there's some, you know, cost versus benefit. I think, you know, risk versus benefit that we have to think about in terms of treatment burden and cost, as well as kind of seeing, you know, paying attention to the safety signals, the adverse events that were there as well. But, you know, looking at this, you know, I'd be curious to see, like, you know, if there was any head-to-head of the tafa-len R-CHOP. But, you know, this might be something that's potentially more effective compared to some of our previous therapies, like we said, the R-CHOP or bull R-CHOP. And I don't know if Dr. Bronstein, do you have any kind of further thoughts about that?
I mean, this was a late-breaking abstract at ASCO that was just presented today. And, you know, it shows a 25% reduction in progression with, if you can believe it, a 7-drug regimen plus R-CHOP. And so, you know, you do get more efficacy, but not surprisingly, you do see, you know, more grade 3 plus adverse events overall with the tafa-len added on, but fewer deaths actually with that regimen. I think it's a great time that we're doing these studies to see if we can beat what's been a long-standing standard of care for first line DLBCL. What's I think somewhat unique about the study is, like you mentioned, they enriched the study with high risk patients, high IPI scores 3 to 5, included ABC, you know, cell of origin. So those patients we know have a higher risk for progression, and I think that's where this regimen could have a role. You know, I don't know. We don't know yet if the 25% reduction PFS translates into an overall survival benefit. So yeah, I think we'll need more data to mature for that. And I think another interesting question, and I'm curious about your thoughts too, is, you know, you're giving a CD19 antibody in this regimen up front. So for patients who don't respond to R-CHOP, namely the high-risk patients, and are primary refractory, the standard of care in that setting for those fit patients is CAR-T against CD19. So what do you do in this setting when someone has not responded or progressed on a CD19 therapy? Do you think they go to CAR-T next or maybe transplant instead?
That's a good question. That's very challenging to say. I don't know exactly, you know, the answer to that one. But, you know, I think it's like Dr. Bronstein mentioned, I mentioned earlier, with those that are high risk, you know, we need to have, it's a challenging question. These are challenging patients. Could it be that we move towards CAR-T? Quite possibly. But, you know, I don't have a great answer to
that. Yeah, there is no answer. We don't know. But I think that you know, you could look at the CD19 target, you know, antigen and see if it's still expressed after TAFA exposure. You know, you could look at bispecifics, maybe in that setting, that target CD20. But, you know, I think that's another reason why we have to see if this translates into an OS benefit, because one, you're exposing these patients to a pretty hefty regimen that can have a lot of toxicity. And two, you're kind of potentially eliminating the CD19 antigen if patients are refractory to this regimen. But I still think that it's exciting. It's an exciting time that we have the ability to add more immunotherapies. You know, R-CHOP was really, I mean, Rituxan was really a game changer when it was added to CHOP, you know, 25 years ago. But adding more immunotherapies up front is an exciting prospect to possibly do better than our longstanding historical standard of R-CHOP. So I think we successfully reviewed all four abstracts in an efficient time frame. We're happy to take any questions from the audience or other topics for discussion.
Great. Thank you both. Very lively discussion. I'd like to pose a question to the two of you. Based on all the data that were discussed today, what would you say is the central theme or takeaway message for the hematologic oncology space from this year's ASCO meeting? I know we've covered a lot of ground today, but if you had to sum it up very briefly, what would you say is the message, so to speak?
So, you know, it's always exciting to be at ASCO and ASH and these large meetings when there's so many stakeholders involved in promoting the science. And so for the heme malignancy space, I think we're in an era of immunotherapy, you know, for myeloma, for lymphoma, using monoclonal antibodies, using CAR T cells, even looking at precursor phases like smoldering myeloma, there's some bispecific data being presented. So I think that, you know, the pace of the science doing these clinical trials, which are happening at breakneck speed and seeing the data come out so quickly and enrolling these patients in these studies so readily, because we know that the efficacy is so high in later lines, and bringing them into earlier lines is, you know, likely to be even more successful. I think the pace of enrollment in these studies is just incredible. So, you know, I think the science, and you know, I'll let Dr. Zahi, you know, comment as well.
I'd say similar. This is my first time here at ASCO, and I've been at ASH previously, and being able to, you know, see how far things have come, even for me as a, you know, a new learner, and again, my first year of fellowship, and seeing some of these, you know, standard therapies that have been around for a while, and now having a lot of new data, a lot of new, you know, phase one or, you know, phase two, phase three studies that are showing really promising results. You know, very exciting time for me as a learner as well.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant, offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.